This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, murder most foul, killing with purpose in speculative fiction.
Now, funny story about this week's episode. It's Jules's fault.
Yes.
And we'll get to why Jules has decided this episode in a minute, but I want to give our listeners a little bit of context about what I have to live with sometimes. And that is that there I am, minding my own business one day, when I get a message from Jules. And I'm like, oh, it's Jules. What does Jules have to say? And Jules sends me a message that says, without any context, this is the first thing she sends me in the day as well. There's no hello or anything like that. It's just straight out with, how do you feel about discussing murder? And then nothing after that. I was like, okay, this is where context is relatively important, Jules, because I can go ahead and assume you're talking about dissecting dragons, or I can assume that you finally snapped and you need an accomplice.
I'd like to think if it was the latter, I wouldn't be stupid enough to leave a text message trail, but you never know. Yes, from my perspective, it was kind of one of those light bulb, oh, we haven't done this moments, and yeah, I probably should have started with good morning or hello or something, but I didn't. I said, how do you feel about discussing murder? Because I was really excited about the idea. And then I was at work when I sent it and something interrupted me, and then I was suddenly, oh shit, I've just sent Madeleine a text asking her to discuss murder with me with no context whatsoever. To find that she just replied with, thank you for sending that to me with no context at all. So there we go. Part of it is obviously that I think we both occasionally suffer from the idea that we live in the other person's head.
Yeah.
So that we assume that the other person will know exactly what we're talking about. And the trouble is 9 times out of 10 we do.
For the most part.
For the most part. There's always just the one where I'll go, what? Or Madeleine will say, hang on a second. Did we have that conversation?
It's quite funny because it does happen in reverse. This is a little tangent, but I happened to mention hurdy-gurdies the other day. First time I've ever mentioned hurdy-gurdies to Jules, and Jules starts getting as excited as I am about hurdy-gurdies. Like, I've been thinking about hurdy-gurdies too!
I know, I have developed a small obsession about hurdy-gurdies over the last couple of years. Never really talked to anyone about it, which makes it sound like it's a weird thing I'm trying to keep private, and I'm not. It's just, that's the way it's happened. And of course, Madeleine said hurdy-gurdy, and I was like, oh my god, someone else who shares my obsession.
Seriously, yes, because I was salivating about hurdy-gurdy prices. I was looking at it and I was like, that's not as expensive as I thought it would be. I could buy that. I mean, I'd have no money ever for the rest of my life, but I could buy that.
Yeah. And we were both just basically saying how much we'd love a hurdy-gurdy. Obviously, I can't play a hurdy-gurdy. I'd like to point that out. But
neither can I, but I'm sure I could learn.
Yeah. It's something to do, isn't it? And it's the fact they're so fascinating because they started off as medieval... I was going to say medieval weapons, but actually no, medieval musical instruments.
I can totally see it as a medieval weapon. You just go onto the battlefield and start playing the hurdy-gurdy.
The French army all draws to a halt. Like, what is that offending our ears?
They're like, oh no, we have to dance! Don't they turn German there, but yeah. The European army. Anyway, we've got off track.
Yeah, murder. This one is my fault, and it's sort of a culmination of things, really, but largely it's Alan had got me to watch Mindhunter.
Right.
Which, basically, it's a dramatised version of events. It's a dramatisation of how criminal profiling came about in the FBI when they were trying to track serial killers. and it's really fascinating, and obviously I'm completely gripped and utterly horrified at the same time. So it's partly that, and it was partly a few other things as well. I think it was you mentioning about the catharsis of writing something dark.
Yes. Yeah.
Sort of clicked in there. And then there's been other things, like it'll be things like news articles and some of the things that have been happening lately. And it just sort of made me think about, it made me think about murder, and not in a I think this is something I'd like to try kind of way, but in a, actually speculative fiction kind of contains a lot of this. And you know, it's used for various different reasons. It's not just, you know, it's not just something that you'd find in a crime novel. They do say the difference between crime and thriller is how quickly a body is revealed. So in crime, it's kind of like if you get a body within the first chapter or two, then it's a crime novel. If it's a thriller, you know, the body comes along a few chapters later. I think that's a sweeping generalisation, but it does seem to be fairly accurate.
Yes.
My library patrons are always horrified when I explain that to them, by the way.
Excuse me, what is this book? Hold on, you just flick through. Body in chapter one. Crime.
Definitely crime.
Found by a jogger. Definitely crime. Okay.
So, when we say murder, presumably everybody knows what we mean by murder.
Just in case.
But, you know, just in case, murder, obviously, killing somebody else. We don't mean manslaughter. We don't mean accidental killing. We're talking about someone acting with intention, even if that intention was only formed within that moment.
Yeah. sorry. It's just, this feels so bizarre.
We've been to stranger places.
One thing that I'm often telling my students is that nobody kills for no reason. Even if it just feels a bit random, like, oh, they just killed because they kind of wanted to, you know, even with the people who just seem to be doing it for the most bizarre reasons, there's still a reason. So when we talk about intention, you know, that intention might be, they slept with my wife, therefore I want revenge. Or it might be, I have an itch inside of me, and this person who has just appeared, I haven't specifically decided that they're going to be the one. It's that, but I have already decided I am going to commit murder because I want to commit murder. So that's what we're talking about when we say intention. So premeditated, it's something, it's an act which has been decided beforehand, and is done with intention.
Yes. So, what does this have to do with speculative fiction? Well, a surprising amount of murder occurs in fantasy and sci-fi. Yes. And horror, obviously, as well. We always leave horror off, but it is speculative fiction as well. And that's even before you have something like a fantasy war or an intergalactic battle. Killing in wartime is obviously a different kettle of fish and something that we've sort of looked at before, so we'll put that to one side for now. But this is, we're really looking at sort of one-on-one violence, largely.
Yeah.
And yeah, a lot of it happens in fantasy and sci-fi, as I said, and definitely in horror.
Yes.
That's another one where it's a case of, is this dark fantasy or is it horror? Well, where does the body occur? The first body. It's like, it's in chapter two. It's probably horror then, isn't it? not quite as accurate, because obviously different types of horror. But yeah, that's a pretty good indicator. Did somebody get gutted in the first couple of pages? Horror. And I suppose the thing is, what is our, you know, what causes our fascination with it? Why does it creep into everything, including speculative fiction, including middle grade fiction? I was sat here thinking, can I think of any middle grade fiction where murder occurs? And yes, lots, yeah. Actually. Looking at Robin Jarvis, 1963. Because, yes, he commits a lot of murders in his books. And not just with his animal protagonists either. Obviously, there's a lot of that. And the idea, obviously, as we've said before, is that if you have an animal protagonist, it removes you slightly so it's not traumatic.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really work, but, you know, that's the idea. But in his middle grade books like the Weird Museum trilogy or the Whitby Witches trilogy, the Whitby Witches, something like 5 murders happen in that book. And it's one woman going around murdering all these other people. And, you know, a lot of it is on page. It's on page murder. So bearing in mind that these books are aimed at 9 to 12 year olds as well. So, yeah, it's something that can crop up anywhere. And I think, you know, it kind of turns up in even younger fiction as well, although I think the handling's a little bit more delicate.
Yeah. The thing is that murder is often in the background of a lot of particularly speculative fiction. Usually also because people want to get rid of parents. Great way of doing that, choppy choppy. So, you know, like, Harry Potter starts with murder. It literally, they're discussing the murder in the first prologue. You know,
the graveyard book. A knife had been brought to the house, and the knife had done almost everything it had been brought to the house to do. And it's like, okay, thank you, Neil Gaiman, for making the murder of an entire family epically creepy and yet still fairly off the page.
Yeah. So there's there's lots of ways in which it can be used. Or rather, in that it can be introduced into a story. And whether that's explicit or not, it still has a really, really big presence within a lot of speculative fiction. That's from, you know, from children all the way to adults.
Yeah, definitely. And I think generally most societies would acknowledge that murder is a terrible crime. Perhaps the most terrible, because you can't recover from it if you're the victim. No. And it is the theft of a life. If you look at the original translation of the Bible, where you have the first murder supposedly being committed by Cain against his brother Abel, when God is talking to Cain afterwards, and, you know, where is thy brother Abel? And Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? And God's like, you know exactly where, you know, if paraphrasing now, God knows, says, you know exactly where your brother is. Your brother's bloods cry out from the ground. And it's a mistranslation in the later versions of the Bible. It says your brother's blood cries out from the ground. It's your brother's bloods, everything he would have been or could have been, all the many hundreds of lives who would have followed his if he'd continued to be a father and a grandfather and a great-great-grandfather, etc. You've murdered an entire line. You haven't just taken one person out. You've taken out everything they could have been, their entire lineage. Yeah. So in biblical terms, it's considered the most terrible in that respect, because you are stealing from, you're stealing from existence. You're stealing from the very world. You don't know what that person would have been. So in that respect, you can twist it in a lot of different ways and use it to drive a plot.
Absolutely. Murder as well is used because it incites very strong feelings, unsurprisingly. And so it's often used in the background of for something for the main character. To witness a murder or to lose someone to murder is a very particular kind of tragedy. You know, losing anyone in general in your life, you know, to some sort of sickness, to an accident, these kinds of things, you know, are terrible. But when it's murder, the victim, the victim dies, obviously, but the person who has to, you know, the survivor, the one who has to live with this person's death, also has to live with the knowledge that this was entirely preventable. And it wasn't preventable in, oh, this was a thing of fate, there was a car collision or, you know, something like that. you know, you can say, oh, well, if only he'd looked both ways before crossing the street or something like that. But preventable in the sense that someone with intention decided to do this. And it's all on that one person. There's no, you know, there's no, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, really. There's no sense of, it was out of our hands. There's this sense of control which has been lost. And it's all because of somebody else, somebody else's decisions. And I think that that is one of the main driving forces for a lot of stories which actually involve murder. That very particular feeling of, this was unnecessary. I really have been robbed, not by the universe, but by a person who has very deliberately done it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So one other thing we'll say on this little section is that, you know, people who are incorporating murder, which actually is most science fiction and fantasy writers at some point, definitely horror writers,
yeah,
is that it can, if you're not careful, fall into the lazy writing bracket. Yes. In the sense of, in the same way where I have ranted at length before about using rape to signal that someone is a bad guy.
Yeah.
Without dealing with the fallout, someone who does it with murder, you know, is only slightly better. It's not enough to say, well, he killed thousands of people. In its case, of you've kind of got to go into that, really. If you've got someone who's a mass murderer, if you've got someone who just murders one person,
yeah,
you've got to look at it a little bit. It's not enough to just say, oh, well, he murders people. That's code for he's a bad guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, again, this comes back to what we said earlier about intention, which is that if you're just having a character who murders people because you want them to be the bad guy, then that doesn't really make any sense. At the end of the day, a murderer is still, you know, is the hero of their own story. They have to have a reason for doing what they do. And to them, that those acts need to be justified. And it needs to actually make sense. Now, that's not to say that we should necessarily be able to empathise with them. Not in the least. You can still absolutely hate them, but there needs to be a reason. And so just very lazily saying, oh, they're just killing people because they're killing people, it kind of lets it down. And it also actually removes the significance of the act, which is a terrible, terrible act. And I think that sometimes, because we're surrounded by violence in media a lot of the time, people forget the fact that murder is pretty significant.
Yeah, and certainly in narrative terms, it's... obviously, as I've said, it's not enough to just say, oh, he murders people.
Yeah.
But I think when you do something really... Terry Goodkind does this. I'm sorry, I'm going to pick on Terry Goodkind again. Actually, I'm not that sorry.
No regrets.
Sometime, I think it's the third or fourth book, he brings in an even worse, more evil guy than... you know, Lord Ral, called Emperor Jagang. And Jagang has got a thing where he just sweeps across the world like a plague and conquers and murders and rapes, etc., etc. And the tales that are told of him and the things he does are so horrible that they don't fit in your head anymore. It's taken to the nth degree. It's like that thing, one death is a tragedy, 2,000 deaths is a statistic.
Yeah.
And don't we all start to get a little bit fatigued like that with the reporting of the coronavirus, for example? So that is how easy it is to lose touch.
Yeah.
So that really bothers me. And I guess it bothers me from the sense of we, as in the British, with the Empire, when we were colonising places, a lot of the time we over-reported the violence done against our own people. And some of that violence did actually happen, you know, the Black Hole of Calcutta, for example. But we're talking about, you know, specific places in Africa where we said that, you know, the tribes who rose against us did X, Y, and Z, which I'm not going to go into because it really is, again, it's one of those, it's so horrific, it doesn't fit in your head.
Yeah.
And it was kind of used as an excuse, you know, these people are the bad guys because they do this, they rape, they murder, they butcher pregnant women kind of thing. Mm. And it feels the same to me when he's describing his characters. That sort of, I can't be bothered to go into details and see them as people and make you understand how terrible they are. The fact that it's even more terrible for them to do these things because they're people just like you.
Yeah.
I'm just going to use this shorthand. And that's very insulting to a reader.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And I do think that there is something to be said about trying to make your villain understandable. It's not an easy process because you don't want people to like these and these characters. Well, sometimes I guess you do. I mean, you've got Deadpool who's running around murdering people left, right, and centre, but we're supposed to like Deadpool, you know? And at the same time...
kind of do like Deadpool, but it's kind of like, yeah, you're a contract killer, you're not really a great guy, are you?
No, he isn't really. This makes me think about, sorry, and I'm sorry to bring it up, but this does make me think about one of the problems I had with A Court of Thorns and Roses towards the end books.
Yeah.
Which is that the main characters would sometimes act with great violence because the whole thing was that, you know, they were supposed to be powerful, etc., etc., etc. And they would act very violently, but it was okay because the people they were acting violently against were always bad.
Yeah.
And so it was justified. It was all justified. And I think that very often what happens is that people want to have that kind of, this is a badass person. They'll just go running around. You know, they're really badass. They're very good fighters. But they don't actually want to show them murdering unless they can justify the murder and say, well, they were a really bad person. If they hadn't killed them, X, Y, and Z, you know? And it's also why I kind of like characters like Malcolm Reynolds from Firefly, because he's not really meant to be a good guy. He's just a cowboy, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So when he murders people, you're like, oh, Jesus. But at the same time, the point is that he's not the big hero. He's not being painted as the savior or anything like that. He's just being painted as a guy who's kind of getting on with his job, which makes sense. So you can still like him, but recognize that actually that was a dickish thing for him to do. But also that he does it because they're someone's firing at him, so he fires back. And in that way, it's justified. But, yeah, I think the problem is that there is this kind of, as you said, we kind of suddenly have this weird distance when it comes to murder. And one thing that people try and do is they try and say, well, it's okay, we can differentiate between whether they're good or bad by who they're murdering. Which is really a problem, because... it's like the good guys are good guys because they're always murdering the bad guys, and the bad guys are the bad guys because they're always murdering the good guys. But who's good and who's bad is a thing of reference.
Yeah, you know? I think it also, and if we're going to look at sort of comic book characters, I mean, dare I say, Batman? Batman has hit the line for him is that he will not kill.
Yeah,
which. I think, honestly, if your Batman is kind of spunking your load against a wall really early on, because anyone that you get into a fight with knows you're not going to kill them.
Yeah.
So there's that. That's already bad. And then if you take Batman and Joker having a... I think it was the killing joke.
Yeah.
Having a conversation, and the Joker's saying, well, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to keep doing this because this is what I do and I love it. Yeah. And the only way you're going to stop me is if you kill me. And Batman's like, I don't kill. And the Joker's like, well, then every person I kill is also your victim.
Yeah.
And it's very uncomfortable because at what point does adherence to a personal code, because Batman doesn't really have a personal morality in a lot of the darker comics.
No.
It's just kind of like, this is the line I won't cross, and then I don't have to think about morality at all. At what point does it become a case of, okay, the responsible thing to do is to shoot this rabid dog so that it stops biting people?
Yeah.
And it's an uncomfortable quandary for most of us.
It's, yeah, it is sometimes, and it's particularly when I watch DC, where I'm just there like, okay, but have you considered, they send them to Arkham, and I'm like, but have you considered the death sentence? And I'm always surprised that one of the Arkham guards doesn't, you know, just
gently swap some rice in the food one night.
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
3 days later, they've had a heart attack.
Oh no!
And we're all very sad.
Like I'm genuinely surprised that that doesn't happen. But yeah, Batman, the whole Batman thing of I shan't kill people. At least in some ways, it makes sense about, you know, why he behaves the way he does. Because as you say, when he goes quite far sometimes. He's,
yeah.
In some stories, Batman is not a nice person. Like, he's a really bad person.
No, he's definitely an anti-hero.
Yeah.
He's just slightly preferable to the alternative in the darker ones.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess there's no real answer to this particular question, but I think it's one you should be considering if you're going to write these sort of characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let's look at reasons that people in real life, and therefore in fiction, might commit murder. The thing to remember, obviously, is that under the right circumstances, almost everyone would commit murder. It's just those circumstances change depending on the person. And your trigger might be a lot finer than, not you personally, Madeline, but your trigger might be a lot finer than mine. Mine might be a long way away, but it is there, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, obviously, reasons for murder. It comes in different flavours, just like ice cream.
Sorry, what's wrong with you?
I'm having fun. Don't rain on my parade. I'm basically Amy. It's like, let's talk about murder. This is great. This is one of my favourite things.
Jesus Christ. Okay.
Well, one of them is convenience. So the character needs to get someone out of the way in order to achieve a goal. So in The Whitby Witches, the witch Rowena is killing off all of Auntie Alice's coven because she's trying to get information. She's desperately trying to get information about the Whitby Guardians because she wants power to break away from her warlock husband. So... yeah, she's killing them, and there's even a certain amount of enjoyment because she probably enjoys the power rush.
Yeah.
And she is not a good person, but it's convenience more than anything else. She's not going around looking for people to murder just for the sheer hell of it. It's a case of, you have something I need, you won't give it to me, or I need to get you out of the way because I need to isolate this one person. Therefore, unfortunately, you're going to die.
Yeah, so it's a case of, this isn't personal. It's just... what's the word I'm looking for? Practical.
Yes. Practical murder. That was a little bit too approving, wasn't it? I'd like to point out I don't actually condone murder except in fiction, and even then, and I'm a little bit cagey on who it is. So yeah, it's convenience. You need to achieve a goal by getting somebody out of the way.
Yeah.
So this is something that definitely happens a lot in historical fiction, because historical fiction is based on real life, usually. Yeah. And in real life, people have done this many, many times.
Yes, unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
It's
it's like when I sent you that bit from Tyrant, and they were in the court, and... the Earl of Gloucester was supposed to show up and give testimony because he'd been arrested.
Yeah.
And instead, Thomas Malbury comes in and sort of sweating and nervous, says to all the waiting notables, "Oh, there's been a terrible accident. The Earl of Gloucester seems to have died, smothered under a mattress in France."
There's been a terrible accident. Oh, has there?
And then Madeline came back to me with, wow, Richard couldn't have been any more obvious unless he'd put his hand to his breast and said, mine own uncle, alas. I'm like, well, you got a point, but this is how it happened.
I know. just Richard like, oh, what? He's dead?
So, yeah. In that instance, obviously, Richard did not want to give his uncle a fair trial and thought it was best to have him out of the way.
Yeah. Like any good king.
Like any good king, yeah. another reason you might murder somebody, revenge.
Yes.
In fact, a revenge arc can be a big part of a science fiction fantasy type scenario.
Yeah. It's quite interesting. The revenge one is an arc which people tend to sort of forgive, in that murder, people tend to feel like murder is okay in this case.
Yeah, there is a sort of ancient form of justice, if you like, that's sort of understood, even if it's not written down, that it requires a life in order to pay for a life.
Yeah.
It's like the Nordic tradition of unlawful killing, and in fairness, the Irish and Scottish tradition, where, you know, grand Scottish tradition, and with the Irish as well, where rivaling clans would actually steal each other's flocks and get into fights and things. But if somebody was killed, then that could provoke a really, really bitter turn to the feud, and there'd be lodge burnings and things like that.
Yeah.
So unlawful, you know, a wife taking a knife to her husband is an unlawful killing. And they had quite interesting ways of looking at it, in the sense of, that wasn't automatically a hanging or burning offence. No. Yeah, they were quite big on burning women. Women who committed adultery and women who murdered their husbands tended to get burnt because they liked to discourage that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So you could, if you could find somebody to pay the arrearc or the body fee, then you might end up in indentured servitude instead.
Mm.
Which, you know, relatively free, but, you know, reporting to one person. But, yeah, obviously they didn't really have prisons and things. So
no.
Things had to be dealt with fairly quickly and concisely. A lot of those sort of scenarios where someone went a bit too far and someone else got hurt led to revenge killings.
Yeah.
Which were not necessarily considered to be murder in some cultures, in the sense of, okay, well, he killed your son and therefore you went and killed him. And as long as you didn't go absolutely nuts and kill his entire family, you were considered to have dealt a blow no stronger than the one dealt to you, and everything was quits.
Yeah, exactly.
In reality, it didn't work out like that, because people tended to get a bit revengey in return. So
you killed my father.
Prepare to die.
Yeah, exactly. It's the eye for an eye thing, which never actually worked practically on a practical level.
No, it did not. Okay, so another one, crime of passion. This is kind of exclusively down to, you in that precise moment were driven out of your senses due to what is perceived to be a natural biological imperative. Therefore, you found your wife or your husband or whoever cheating on you, and you shot them both dead. It's not excusable. You will still serve time for murder. It's just, they'll consider that in many cases that you were sort of driven out of your senses if you did this.
Yeah.
I don't agree with this. I realise I'm disagreeing with a body of law, but I still think this is kind of bollocks. And I don't love seeing it in fiction, unless I'm, you know, unless we're using it to a specific turn of events. It's just, yes, I kind of get it, but I think that most people are not so consumed with jealousy and rage in a moment that they would actually kill someone they love. And I think there's something really, really off with society that thinks that that is an appropriate proportionate response.
Yeah. I think because the crime of passion thing can happen on several levels, and you start to stray into another territory, which is actually separate, which is a crime, you know, self-defense, yeah. An act of self-defense. But you might also get that, this kind of this in-between space whereby perhaps you perceive someone else. It's not that you feel that you yourself are in danger, but that you feel that somebody else is in danger.
Yeah.
And so you step in before it happens.
Yeah, I wouldn't call that a crime of passion. That's self-defense.
Yeah. But you can, there's this kind of a sliding thing in that sort of depending on the situation, yeah, being, it's about the provocation of strong emotion, which basically overrides anything which would prevent you from usually doing this sort of thing. And that's what you know, Jules and I mean by saying that everyone, pretty much everybody, has a line which they would cross and they would commit murder given certain situations.
Yeah.
And I think it is different for everybody, but, you know, there's a scale there going on. So the crime of passion, yeah, that basically the idea that an emotion completely overcomes that wall, which would stop you from doing that. And whether that is jealousy, or anger, or desperate, you know, need to protect or something like that. So they are separate, but it comes from, you know, that same place of basically an emotion being the thing which overrides it, a strong emotional
yeah.
response.
So specifically with a crime of passion in speculative fiction, it is nearly always a lovers or husband and wife type scenario. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think of, I think there's been some that they haven't really registered with me except to say, for me to sort of roll my eyes and go, oh, okay, we're doing this, are we? Which bugs me. I guess the thing is, you can love or hate Wuthering Heights, and you should absolutely be appalled by Heathcliff and not think that he's someone you want to hang out with. But no matter what you say about Heathcliff, he wants to murder Linton all the way, Edgar Linton all the way through. Genuinely, Edgar Linton marries the girl that he wanted to marry, but he doesn't. He doesn't do anything like that. I mean, he sets himself a revenge task of basically ruining Edgar's entire family and controlling them and sort of reenacting the past events so that everyone is as miserable as him. But he actually says to Kathy, you know, while you desired his society, I would never have harmed a hair on his head. Sort of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas Linton actually did threaten Heathcliff with a gun. So it's a case of Linton being a weaker, more insecure person was willing to shoot Heathcliff even though Kathy wanted him around. And I think that's an interesting yeah. dichotomy there. But basically what I'm getting at is if even someone like Heathcliff, who's kind of like, murder, yeah, okay, fine, because Kathy's the only other person in the world who's really real, is willing to go, okay, I guess I won't kill them then because she wants them alive, then the crime of passion thing doesn't really hold water for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I can see your point, but at the same time...
It might be that I'm not wired that way as well. So,
no, I agree. I do. Again, I think the whole crime of passion thing is very specific, and I don't understand it because I do think that even at your most angry, to want to kill somebody, you know, in that moment, there has to have been something else driving you as well. There has to have been something else which was ticking inside.
Yeah, definitely. It's a stack on type, a stacking effect, isn't it? It's not just one thing. And
yeah.
In a lot of cases, it's men, and a lot of those cases, it's men who feel that they have been made to look foolish and they have a deep insecurity.
Yeah.
So there's that. Another one, obviously, necessity, preservation of life or self-defense, which obviously Madeline's touched on. So, yeah, you're a mother and somebody's coming for your child. Yeah, that person's dead.
Yeah.
Or someone is trying to attack you and you end up going, well, it's them or me. I guess it's them. That's a perfectly natural reaction, by the way. And then a lot of hand-wringing afterwards is kind of like, eh, you know, how guilty do you have to feel about it? Maybe you'd rather not have killed them, but are you seriously telling me you'd stand there and say, oh, I'd rather you killed me than I killed you?
Yeah. It makes me think of, because I've got an example of that, obviously, in Blood of Delphi with Rufus. Now, up until this point, Rufus has killed a few people in self-defense, in that they have been trying to capture him, and so he's killed them because he knows what they'll do to him once they've captured him. And he doesn't feel great about it, but he's kind of been able to sort of keep the line because he really didn't have another choice in those moments.
Yeah.
And then he gets put into a situation where he's basically raped. Even though he technically consents to it, it's under duress, and he really doesn't have a choice. And then he finds out that the guy he was with betrayed him regardless. So even though he said, if you do this, I won't report you. But he reported him anyway. And then he makes sort of a mild threat about saying, don't worry, I'll take care of your son, Joshua. And Rufus just freaks out and stabs him very, very violently in the face and in the neck and in all sorts of places. And this is basically a culmination of the fact that, first of all, there's been a threat against Joshua. But second of all, a big part of it is that he feels he's had his power stripped away from him in a lot of ways. He's not very well anyway, but he's actually really angry. So there is an element of crime of passion coming into it as well. A large part of it, as I said, is obviously the fact that Joshua is being threatened. But realistically, Rufus sort of knows that Joshua would be fine, that Joshua would not end up there, that Joshua would escape or come and be saved by somebody. He kind of, in the back of his mind, there's no part of him that actually believes that Joshua is going to be stuck there for the next few years. But it's a culmination of all of these things. And then, of course, he finishes with the murder and he looks down at what is essentially an incredibly messy body. And freaks out about it because he realises he really didn't need to kill this guy. He could have very easily incapacitated him and then just run off. But he didn't. Because, as I said, there was this emotion basically took the better of him. And part of that was anger. And part of that was protection. This is what I meant by sometimes there can be, you know, a sliding scale a little bit. I would still definitely put Rufus's down to self-defense in that particular case.
Yeah, I mean, we've divided all these up for convenience, but obviously two or more can apply at any given time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is just to make it easier to discuss, but obviously there can be several things going along. So another reason you might murder someone, you're a professional. This is what you do to make money. It's not personal. Someone has taken a contract out on you. You can't be a very good person if they've taken a contract out on you, because who is a decent, upstanding citizen who gets a contract taken out on their life? There must be something you're doing wrong. Or, you know, that tends to be the sort of morality it follows. We've obviously done an episode on assassins, and I admit to my ongoing fascination with them as characters. I do enjoy a good assassin story as long as they actually kill people. It's kind of an issue for me. I'm the greatest assassin, blah blah blah. Anyway, we've been down that road. But yeah, professional, you're an assassin. You're Mia Covere, for example, in Nevernight. And at no point does she say, I'm one of the good guys. She does desperately try and hang on to her humanity. She doesn't kill people unless she has to. But at the same time, if it's you or her, then it's you. And if you're between her and her revenge, it's you. You know, you're gonna die.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I do like the point that they say, well, we kill people for money. Did you really think we're the good guys?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yes.
The whole... That whole thing is really interesting. The whole killing for money thing. Because, as you say, it's inherently not good to murder people for money. I can't believe that needs to be explained. but there you go. It's not, murdering people for money is in general not considered to be a good thing that people should be doing.
And yet, it makes such a great fantasy and sci-fi type. I mean,
it really does.
In fact, you might not know because I think this was pre you being born. But the whole fetish over Boba Fett from the original Star Wars trilogy was the fact he was a bounty hunter and assassin, and he had this tiny bit part, but they kept bringing him back because all the kids loved him. They loved this character. I think he's got like 3 lines in the entire trilogy.
Yeah, he's very, very much liked. I mean, isn't he part of the Mandalorian?
He is now, but again, this is a case of, oh, he was a fan favourite, so I'm sure that's why they brought him in.
No one quite knows why everybody likes him, but everybody does like him.
Okay, which brings us to our final category for this one, and that is for fun. You might murder people for fun. And I use the word fun there loosely because now we're into serial killer territory. Largely.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been lots of successful serial killers who have actually ruled nations, and we haven't called them serial killers simply because they've been in power and therefore what they say goes. So we have to bear that in mind. But if we're looking at a genuine serial killer, somebody who either gets their rocks off on murder and justifies it in other ways, or someone who is developing a psychosis to the point where they need to start murdering other people. Mm. It's too complicated. I see things like mental illness and psychopathy and things thrown around with reference to serial killers. And yes, there might be elements of that, but that isn't everything. That's part of a very, very complex structure. And there are plenty of psychopaths out there who are perfectly functioning members of society who do not go around killing people. So,
yeah. And again, it comes down to intention. Something I frequently found in a lot of students' work, and something that I would talk, and not just students' work, but just work in general, something that I would frequently talk to my students about, particularly when teaching the Gothic, was that people don't just commit murder because they're, in inverted commas, mad. And when you do have someone who is murdering because of something, you know, some kind of mental illness, or because they are a serial killer of some kind, there is a reason for it. There is a reason why this act, you know, that makes them happy. There's usually a pattern of behaviour. It's not just, I will go out and kill any random person. Why are they killing? What are they getting from it? What has provoked them to want to do this? And it might very well be that, well, I just happen to really like the way that it feels, but why? There's usually a reason, there's usually a pattern, and you can't just say, well, and they just murder people X, Y, and Z, like this, that, and the other, because they're crazy. It doesn't work like that.
It's not enough. I think if you're going to write something that involves a serial killer, even in a fantasy, sci-fi, or horror setting, it's worth understanding what we now know. And, you know, these things are changing all the time. So, for example, chances are, if you've got a serial killer, mid-20s to mid-30s, white male of a background that can be troubled and generally has a poor relationship with their mother or had a father who was abusive, and has some sort of, I don't want to say deviated, but deviated in an introverted way, sexual arousal pattern, which means that they don't really get off on the idea of sex. They kind of get off on the idea of murder. So when they say lust killings when in talk with serial killers, that might be a serial killer who goes for a specific, you know, blonde, this sort of size and shape, this sort of age bracket. Yeah. And I just get one of those whenever I need to scratch an itch. And there may be the whole rape, torture, kill kind of thing with that. Or it may just be a case of, no, I get them. I kill them by bopping them on the head. I then plait their hair and then I cut them open. And it gives the same sort of release. I mean, it's very disturbing if you start looking into it, so make sure you're in a good mental place. But just have some of the basics. There are female serial killers, but they're very, very rare.
Yeah.
So rare that you could kind of probably fit them all into one book, the ones that we know about.
Yeah. But as you said, there's a reason, and there's usually a pattern, so... you know, people say, oh, they leave their, you know, their particular type of signature. That's not necessarily because someone goes, and now I will leave my mark. It's because this is part of their ritual for why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah, let's talk about, just briefly, Edmund Kemper, who is 6'9", big bloke, 260 pounds, maybe more.
Yikes.
Big guy, and... during the sort of 60s and 70s, as a teenager, he murdered his grandparents, but he was under 18, so the books got shut on it. He killed his mother by beheading her and then having sex with her neck.
Oh, God.
I'm not going to say his mother had it coming, but she definitely contributed to the problem that became Edmund Kemper. And then there were various others. You know, he was very organized. He was methodical about it. It became a ritual, what he describes as a vocation. That's very disturbing. Someone describing it as a vocation. And he was intelligent, articulate, and very well spoken. He's still alive, by the way, and in prison in America. He has been offered parole several times and he's refused it every time because he says he will go back and do the same thing again. In fact, he's actually argued on several occasions that he ought to have the death penalty and he ought to be killed by torture.
Wow.
That's not to say, well, you know, obviously he's a good misunderstood guy, because he's not, and the things he did are very disturbing. And I have really not gone into detail at all. But I think it's worth looking at that because, as Madeline says, no one does what they do for no reason. He had a set of very rigid rules for what he did. And a lot of it had to do with his mother humiliating him and locking him in the cellar. And I think there may have been some sexual abuse going on there as well, or something that was sexual adjacent. Yeah. And all of that, you know, you can't lay it all in one place, but it's kind of like you take two dogs, and if you methodically torture and ruin both dogs, one dog may still be a redeemable creature at the end of it. But you do the same thing to another dog, and that dog becomes a killer. It becomes, you know, basically your dog of war. So I think it's a little bit similar with people. It depends what ingredients you've got. It's definitely nurture is involved, but there's something to do with nature as well.
Absolutely, This is very dark.
This is very dark. We've skimmed over the surface about serial killers, and I won't go into it because it's a huge topic, and I am not well informed enough, quite frankly. I find it interesting, and sometimes I like to look into dark, but honestly, I am not well informed enough to really give an opinion on the subject.
No.
I mention it only because we have a massive fascination with repeat murderers like this. So, to the point where you get, you know, I want to say Robert Lindsay, but it's not Robert Lindsay. Ah, it's gone. Anyway, the guy who wrote the Dexter series, and which then became a TV show. And they made him even nicer on the TV show. And we kind of liked it. We wanted to be in his corner. And we enjoyed the fact that he was clever and outwitting people. And the people he killed were, you know, people who clearly deserved it. And it was fun, in a way. But at the same time, did anyone else stop and think, hang on a minute, it's disturbing how sympathetic we are to this guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is funny because even when you get characters like this, it's very difficult to read about characters who are committing murder unless you feel like there is some kind of justification. So with Deadpool, you kind of get away with all of the murders he's committing because it's written off as funny.
Yeah.
And it's very fictionalized, which means that there's never any sense of real consequence. You never get the sense that of life actually being lost. So it's okay, because the main focus is on Deadpool and Deadpool himself. It could almost all be a dream, you know. Whereas American Psycho, I think that's what it's called.
Yeah.
I've not even read the book. I've heard excerpts from it, and it literally haunted me. And it's one of these sort of classic novels, which people say you've kind of got to read. But the whole point of it is that it's meant to be disturbing. It's meant to be difficult to read, because at the end of the day, we don't really want to be in the head of someone who's that disturbed. We want to have a reason to, you know, to engage with them. We want to understand why they're committing the crimes that they're committing. And so it's very, very difficult when you get into the head of a character who just feels so irredeemable, and yet you're then given a reason, you know, examples of why they're doing what they're doing, but you still don't agree with it. And that's really hard. So, and not a lot of people can stomach it, which is why when you do get series like Dexter and stuff like that, they make the character likable, as it were. They give this little glimmer of, he could be actually a good person. Look, you know, he has a wife, and then he has a son. Look, every now and again he exhibits that there might be something a little bit human in there. And so, you know, you hold on to that, like, well, deep down he must be a good person because of the choices that he's made. And it allows you to live with the things that he's doing. I would like to point out, obviously, that there is a big difference between being sort of liking a character like Dexter on a TV show. I can like Deadpool as a character. That doesn't mean that I'm actually gonna like a real life mercenary if I ever met one, or that I'd approve of any of these kinds of things if they actually happened in real life.
Yeah, definitely. We, as in Alan and I, watched both seasons of You on Netflix recently. Yeah. And this follows a guy who, I think he's called Joe Goldberg. And what he seems to do, I don't want to give spoilers away, because if you're going to watch it, you kind of need to watch it without knowing what's going to happen. He would not describe himself as a serial killer or a stalker, but he does find himself an obsession, a woman to be sort of obsessed over. And he has no boundaries when it comes to manipulating her into going out with him
right. At
all. And, you know, murder does happen. And then you find out what the history is behind him. So when you come in on this, he's obsessing about the woman who came into his bookshop, Guinevere Beck. And he's really, really into her. And it's interesting how it plays with your sympathies, because sometimes you think, actually, he's kind of got a point about some of the things he sees. He's very sociopathic.
Right.
So, and I mean that literally in the sense of has very good instincts for survival and can see things in other people that most of us cannot see. But he's not really a particularly competent serial killer. So you feel every time he does something right, you're kind of like laughing a little bit, and then suddenly you'll get that, it'll slap you back down again, and you're like, hang on a second, this is not okay.
Yeah.
This is bad. I don't know, I've got mixed feelings about it. It was very interesting, definitely, but peopled with absolutely terrible people.
Gives me the chills.
So it was interesting, and, you know, some things were fairly accurate. The sort of the idea of somebody getting obsessed and then stalking, and the fact that, you know, being a bit secure with your internet and stuff is a really, really good idea. Maybe not posting everything about yourself online, for example. I wince every time someone posts really openly about something deeply private, personal, and very sort of sensitive in terms of feelings, because you've just put that out there. And if someone happens to be sort of fixated on you, you've just given them an in to opening a conversation with you in real life.
Yeah.
You've just made it really, really easy for somebody to manipulate you. So every time I see someone do that, I'm kind of like, don't do that. You know, there's being authentic and honest, and then there's also inner head thoughts. You know, there's private conversations for your friends.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, that's years and years of teaching women's self-defense. I cannot quite get over the whole not noticing thing, you know, not observing that someone's parking by your house all the time, or not observing that, you know, you keep bumping into this person when you're going to a news agent or whatever. It can be innocent, but it's best to cultivate a bit of paranoia, basically, is what I'm saying. Okay, so moving on from serial killers. How murder can be used to drive a plot.
Right, so...
So, I mean, this is fairly straightforward, and if we say it, you'll probably go, oh yeah, there's all these examples as well, but obviously for mystery. So perhaps you're writing urban fantasy and you have a PI vampire or witch or whatever.
Sorry,
who
you
needs
said
to investigate a murder.
You said witch and
the Kestrel rose from her grave.
What did you call me? That wasn't specific to you. Go back to sleep.
So yeah, murder. So Laura Larkso's Fallible Justice series quite often focuses around a murder or a couple of murders. You have Yania Wild, who is one of the wild folk, who ends up sort of investigating these sort of murders and things. So that works really, really well, and having the inciting incident of murder.
Yeah, it's the same with Dresden Files as well.
Yeah, certainly the early ones.
Definitely.
So that's always a good one. Revenge arc, as we've talked about. So again, things like Never Night with Mia Corveri. That is very much a revenge-driven story from beginning to end. There is much blood.
There certainly is. I'd even say also with the Hamartia cycle is basically just a revenge story.
There's a strong element of that. I would also say, and this is the mirror of the revenge arc, is the redemption arc. I would say the Hamartia cycle is also, if you flipped over, a redemption arc story.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, because Madeline hasn't given me the third or fourth book yet. So, you know, just saying. But based on what I've read.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the redemption arc is quite an interesting one. You can have it from the perspective of somebody commits a murder and then spends a long time trying to atone for it. Or a case of somebody witnesses a murder and doesn't speak up or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's lots of ways. It just depends where you put the body, once again. Where's the body?
In the swamp.
You can also use murder to drive a plot by adding complications to an ongoing arc, which is something I did with I Am the Silence.
Yeah. Because those kids don't have enough to worry about with that.
Yeah, they really don't. I mean, well, the several murders take place with I'm the Silence, along with various other nasty things. But there is a point where I would argue that it is self-defense, even though she didn't need to defend herself at that point in time, where M chooses not to interfere with somebody dying.
Yeah.
She chooses to, you know, she knows afterwards that she could have prevented the dead from taking this person. She could have not thrown him at them, even though he was trying to kill her at that time. She knew she was stronger and he had no chance of winning.
Yeah.
And she made a very cold, calculated decision that he was too dangerous to be allowed to live.
Yeah.
And then she has to live with the fact that she doesn't feel bad about that decision later on. And it sort of screws everything up for her for a while.
It really does, doesn't it?
Yes.
It is also quite interesting because I liked that storyline because it actually looked at the other side of sort of living with murder as a murderer, which is that instead of going that, oh god, I can't believe I've done that, I can't believe I feel so guilty about it. The thing that M feels guilty about is the fact that she doesn't feel guilty, that the fact that she turns around and goes, yeah, and I do it again.
Yes. I wish it hadn't been necessary, but I would still do the same thing again because it was the right thing to do.
Exactly. And that was really interesting because she began to fear, well, what else am I capable of? So I did quite like that. Because it's something which tends to be quite underexplored, because usually when you have the hero, they're meant to be agonising over what they've done for a very, very long time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, whereas Lucas was like, oh yeah, he had it coming to him, it's fine, don't worry about it.
Lucas is just shrug. I mean, to be honest, I feel like a part of Lucas might just kill someone if they, I don't know, like, smashed a violin. I feel like...
That's like entirely possible. That's like, oh my god, a Stradivarius, what were you thinking?
Lucas is ready to throw down. Let's not lie. So yeah, definitely. Oh god, I just had an example in my head as well, and it just flew right out. Just went, and out it goes. But yeah, I did quite like that. Because you do tend to have that, the umming and ahhing of, oh, what have I become? Instead of the, no, I do it again, and I kind of feel a bit like people wouldn't accept me because of that.
Yeah. And as you say, what else am I capable of? This kind of means I'm not one of the good guys, doesn't it? I always thought I was. Yeah. So what am I?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so, I don't know if I should say it like this, but tips for committing murder in fiction.
This is a little announcement from the dragons. We do not condone murder. Do not commit murder. No matter what you've heard today or what you're about to hear, we in no way are suggesting that these are viable and good ways to commit murder in real life. Do not commit murder in real life. Thank you for listening to the small PA.
If you're adding a murder plot to your speculative fiction, you might want to consider some of these things. So, for example, in the same way that no one should exist just to be raped in order to signal that someone else is a bad guy, no one should just exist to be murdered. So even if you're turning up when the body is still cooling on the ground, we should later find out that that person was actually a person and they had pets and hopes and they had hobbies and were interested in things.
Yeah.
We should feel like they were actually a person. They're not just a body, basically.
Yeah. Even if that person is a bad person, they should be a person. Now, again, depending on how you're using the murder, you might want to accentuate that, or you might want to actually leave them as fairly flat. For instance, again, using Deadpool, because he just happens to be a good example. Deadpool doesn't really want the bad guys to be, you know, the thugs that he kills to be wholesome characters, because that's the whole point, is that they're not. They're just kind of like, it's like, you know, pushing down a paper cutout. A cardboard cutout of a person and making a joke about it. But when very, you know, when you actually are adding murder into a plot, make sure that you're actually killing a person, not a vague outline.
Not just a paper doll kind of thing. I'd also say, if you have characters that you do not know what to do with, don't just murder them.
Yeah.
I mean, you may very well need to murder them at some point, but don't use it as a default. The problem with this is, if you've got characters and you've got yourself stuck and you don't know what to do with this character, then there's a good chance that character doesn't need to be in that book.
Yeah.
So by murdering them, you're deviating the plot even further. You're compounding your problem.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's the question of kill your darlings. You know, you set something in a war, you want to add a violent tone and stuff like that. Understandable, then, there needs to be deaths. That just makes it realistic. The problem is that if you do that and you just sort of murder people left, right and centre, you're kind of doing yourself a disservice, because it means there's no time for the impact of what happened. And if you are not murdering someone for the impact, then why are you doing it, as it were? Why have you chosen murder?
As we've obviously talked about when to kill off a character, if they can serve the plot far more by being alive, then leave them alive.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Remember, story is king.
Story is king. But also, it's just... Yeah, murder... You don't need to kill a whole bunch of people. You don't need to murder the entire family. Murdering one person can be enough, actually, sometimes. Because death is horrific and traumatic and stays with you. Murder even more so. So you can actually make the most of that. And if you use it too much, then you sort of... you kind of actually reduce the significance of the characters, you reduce the significance of everything, and it kind of falls a bit flat. So,
yeah.
Murder responsibly!
Murder responsibly. Also, in the tone of murdering responsibly, avoid diversity and sexism fails.
Yeah.
So, do not try to avoid the girl in the refrigerator trope for a start. So no woman should die just in order to drive a man to act. And part of the problem is that's the characterization thing as well. So having a body that had never been a person on page and never will be. And that usually, you know, that was something that usually fell to women because it was a male driven plot. And then after that, it sort of became, you know, well, we've got one black character. Guess who's getting it?
Yeah.
And now it's kind of like, we've got one gay or trans character. Guess who's going to get murdered?
Yeah.
Try not to do those things. Try to murder somebody else.
Yeah.
That sounded really bad. of your characters in fiction, if somebody has to die, ask yourself why it has to be that character. And are you killing off the only token representation of something?
Yeah. Now, it might very well have to be that character for completely different reasons. But if it's just, I need a murder, so it's going to be someone and they're dispensable, then first of all, you've got to ask yourself, why did you have that character be dispensable? Because I think that tends to be the thing. It's, I need to have a murder, but it needs to be someone who's a dispensable character. And the problem is that the minority characters tend to be the dispensable ones. So look at that. Think very carefully. Well,
that's the thing, isn't it? Authors go, oh, well, I want to be inclusive and I want to make sure I have a gay character or a black character or what have you. So they do. And then it's a case of, I don't really feel comfortable writing this character, and it becomes so much easier to then just kill them off for convenience.
Yeah. And for tragedy.
And it, you know, it's just, try not to do that. Okay, the murders should be as brutal as they need to be, but not gratuitous. And by gratuitous, I mean, if you're writing grimdark, then yeah, there might be a lot more intestines and blood and things.
Yeah.
It's genre specific, but at the same time, there should not be a point where it feels like torture porn, I guess.
Yeah.
This is a case of, no, it's as bloody and as unpleasant as it needed to be for that particular genre, for that book, for that character, for those scenes. This is what I was talking about with Terry Goodkind, where you get to a stage of horror where it stops meaning anything. It's just words on a page. It doesn't matter what you do to that person now, because that is no longer horrific. You have shut the reader out.
Mm. Yeah. I think of Game of Thrones as well. There are some very horrific murders in Game of Thrones. To the extent that I sort of switched off a little bit. But I guess they were sort of well enough paced that it didn't do it too badly. But I still, I kind of got to the point going, whatever happened to just a good old stabbing?
There's nothing wrong with the classics, you know. Yeah, Yeah, completely. The only thing I'll say about Game of Thrones was that in general the characters were well done. So you know, if you responded to that character at all, then their death actually meant something. And this is part of the problem with Goodkind and people who write like him, is the fact that a lot of the characters don't have any characterization. So it's a case of you're doing horrific things and it's the paper doll thing. Yeah.
God, you hate Terry Goodkind.
I don't hate him. The trouble is, the first two books were quite good. I think I've got some deep-rooted frustration with myself for giving him a chance as long as I did, because I would never do that with an author. Life is too short.
You wasted. It's the longest. You wasted my time, Terry.
Yeah, life is the longest thing we'll ever do, and yet it's still too short to read books like that. Okay, the last thing to think about, we've talked about this as well, is if your character is the murderer, it's something they won't ever come back from quite the same. So you should be thinking about how it changes them, and what are you saying by your story by having them do this? Was there a justification at all? If you're doing it just to add action or because you don't know what else to do and you don't intend to deal with the fallout, maybe try something else. You know, stampede a herd of bison or something through.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, sorry, all of this, it makes me think about Hannibal Lecter.
Well, it probably should do, because, you know, serial killers, but...
But in the series Hannibal, there was a joke I saw which stayed with me, because I never got the whole way through Hannibal. As people know, I'm not a big fan of horror or anything like that. And I tried, because it looked interesting. But first of all, watching Hannibal made me unreasonably hungry, which was uncomfortable, because the food looked so good, and then I remember that it had people in it, but then I remember that it is just a set and it doesn't really have people in it, but I know that it's meant to have people in it, and I just had to stop watching. Okay. But this one joke I saw really, really made me laugh, in that they had a shot of the detective, the head of the department, the black guy, whose name I can't remember, and he's just staring at the face of this murdered person who's been kind of mounted on like a dinosaur skeleton or something like that, or that like the body's been slowly ripped apart. It's just so disgusting. And you see this police detective who looks exhausted, and someone's just written, "A shooting. Why can't I just have a simple shooting? Why is it always like this? Just one shooting, one fatal stabbing." And you're like, yeah, this city really does have some really disturbing, like, every time he turns up, it's some artful shit. Like, why are all these murderers just taking so much time? There's no simple things. He just looked so exhausted.
You'd be looking for a transfer to another police department, wouldn't you, really?
I've had enough of
this. No, this is someone else's problem.
It also makes me think, it was what someone counted the number of murders that happen in Morse, and they're like, if the proportionate number of murders that happened in Morse actually happened in Oxford, it would have the highest crime rate of anywhere in England, or something like that.
Yes.
So yeah, murders in fiction, you can tend to sort of be able to get away with a little bit more. But you don't need to go massively over the top in order to have the shock value, because the emotional shock can be enough. I mean, it's fine to have a violent murder as well, or to have a very, you know, shocking or brutal murder, and obviously depending on the genre, you might want to have, you know, a murder which involves a body being turned into a cello. You might want to do that.
For instance, as an example.
Yeah, sorry, again, something else from Hannibal.
Okay.
Like I said, it was some weird stuff, Jules.
It really was.
You know, so you might want to have that, but at the same time, you don't need to have that. Sometimes, as I said, a good old stabbing, a little shooting, you know, a breaking the neck, you know, bonking on the head. These things can also be acceptable. You don't need to go artfully, I'm going to kill them by pouring hot metal over their faces.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or arranging them in a, I don't know, a spiral or something like that. It doesn't need to be like that.
No. They're still just as dead.
Yes.
I suppose when it comes to murder, it's a case of all of us have, as we've said in a previous episode, all of us have dark thoughts. Yeah. So we need to be okay with that. And as Madeline has also said, there's a sort of catharsis in exploring that and then being able to come back from the brink. And that explains some of our fascination with serial killers and murderers.
Yeah, absolutely. As we said at the beginning, everybody does have that line. And everybody has, you know, violent thoughts as well. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, as you just said, Jules, that doesn't mean that you would ever actually act on these things, or that you actually have a desire to act on these things at all. But most women I know actually do have a weird thing about, like, sort of serial killers. I mean, I think there's a reason that women read a lot of crime fiction. And I also think that, you know, there's a correlation between women reading crime fiction and women often being the victims of these kinds of violent crimes and the catharsis that comes along with that. So, yeah, murder definitely has an important place in fiction. You'd be hard-pressed, really, to remove murder from fiction nowadays because it is so important, because it is such a significant thing in real life. So to try and remove it from fiction, it just never would work.
Yeah. Okay, on a complete minor tangent, did you ever used to play Cluedo?
Yes. I love that game.
I love Cluedo. Cluedo is brilliant. Okay, there's now Junior Cluedo. Nobody gets murdered in Junior Cluedo. Do you know what happens? Someone steals a slice of cake.
Oh, wow.
The entire game is predicated on finding out who stole the cake. And I'm like, okay, I played the proper adult version of Cluedo from sort of the age of 6 up, and I was fine with it. Why have they made Junior Cluedo?
Yeah.
But apparently some children, and my nephew apparently is one of them, are sensitive enough that they get very upset at the idea of it. So they don't want that. They're not playing adult Cluedo, they're playing junior Cluedo.
Right.
I don't know how Who Stole the Slice of Cake is managed with, you know, Mrs. Plum in the pantry with the lead pipe or whatever. How does that work?
She took the cake with the pipe. Someone took the cake with the rope. To be honest, Cluedo also always really baffled me, because how bad is the detective that he's like, I have no idea how this body was killed. He could have been hanged, could have been bludgeoned to death. I have no idea. I can't even fathom what the weapon is.
Yeah, you'd think that fairly soon it'd be a case of, oh, well, they were obviously shot, or, you know, blunt force trauma.
Also, like, I assume what's probably happened is that the murder took place in a room of the house and then the body's been moved. But if that's not the case, then again, terrible detective, because it's like, where could this person have been murdered? I don't know, maybe in the room that you found them in. Anyway, we're okay. Not going to talk about the logistics of Cluedo.
We're gonna come back. I'm sorry I introduced that. Okay, wrapping up, your favourite murderer or murderers in speculative fiction, Madeline?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so, have mentioned him several times. I do like Deadpool as a character.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
I do think he's interesting. Again, would not condone that in real life in any shape or form.
No, me neither.
It's funny, because this isn't my favourite, but again, just talking about my characters, I have Aaron in the Hamasho cycle, who I love to write. He's my assassin, obviously. Eren is not a good person. Eren is not someone you would want to meet in person. If he was a real person, he'd be very worried. He's a terrible, terrible human being. And yet, I've got a friend, I won't name them, who, Eren is their favourite character. Just 100% their favourite character. Every time Eren commits a murder, it's hilarious.
Brilliant.
So yeah, so that's, Eren is probably my favourite murder character to write, along with Zachary, who has also committed a fair amount of murders.
And cannibalism.
And cannibalism, yeah. Let's not forget that.
That's if anyone could. I'd go with Mia Corveri, obviously, yeah. Because I love me a good assassin, especially a hot assassin chick, so pretty much my catnip right there.
Again, we must stress we are talking about fictional characters.
Yeah, fantasy, not reality.
Not reality. We are definitely not one of those kinds of people who get our...
Want to marry...
Yeah, who marry people in jail and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there are some great characters. And again, murder in fiction is very different from murder in real life. I think we're running out of time now. But we obviously still do have time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe that you've got one for us today.
Yes, I have been reading Alex Bledsoe's Tufa series. Now, aside from the linguistic headache it's kind of given me, because Tufa is supposed to be a slurration of Tuatha,
mm-hmm.
except that he clearly has never heard it said, and he's been saying it Tuatha, as in the Tuatha De Danann. So that's where Tufa has come from. But basically, it's set in Western Tennessee, in an area of the mountains, and the idea is that there is a fairly dark-skinned, black-haired people who live there who are not Native American, and apparently have lived there since long before the Native Americans originally colonized the area. Mm-hmm. And they call themselves the Tufa, and they largely keep themselves to themselves. And as things go further on, you realize that actually they were a branch of the outcast Shi, who were sent from Ireland.
Right.
When their king offended, you know, the queen of the Tuatha De Danann, and it's really interesting. It's kind of urban fantasy, but with a rural setting, and each book reads as a standalone. Although, you know, characters from previous books will pop up, and that, you know, you can see that they're in order, but you won't lose anything by reading them out of order. And it's just they're just really, really good. If you like Holly Black, this is like gritty. Fairy tales for adults, sort of following on from the Holly Black sort of tradition, but definitely for adults. The only thing I will say is content warning for racial and misogynistic pejoratives. They're always used as part of a character's dialogue. It's part of establishing the fact that characters in that area can be quite racist and sexist. Yeah. And it's always challenged on page, but if you're someone who doesn't like to see those things in print, then it might not be for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really, really good. They're eerie, there's a certain sense of folk horror, and the thing that I think Madeline would like most about them is that the Tufa are a very musical people. All of them play an instrument and or sing. And what they do with their music, I mean, they can play or sing pretty much anything, although they don't really like some of the more modern stuff because it's got a sort of meanness that they don't appreciate. But they do a lot of the Tufa music is actually folk songs, and there's a code within the folk songs, and the songs themselves are used to weave glamours and to sing someone's funeral dirge, for example, and to manipulate time and to ride the night winds and things. And it's just really, really interesting.
That's very, very cool. I definitely have to check that out. Okay. Thanks very much for listening, guys. Do leave us a comment. Let us know who your favourite murderers are. Fictional.
Fictional murderers.
And whether you agree with us, whether you disagree with us, remember you can get in contact with us via Facebook or Twitter or individually as well. And for now, we'll say hope everyone's keeping well, and thanks very much for listening.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.